Well, that's adorate devote in Latin, a Catholic hymn from written by Thomas Aquinas in the 13th century, a doctor of the Catholic Church, a man very prominent involving issues involving faith and reason, which we want to talk to about today here on another episode of Conservative Casual Friday with your show host, Andrew Herod, a weekly show where we issues for conservatives and others. Today we want to talk about such ideas of faith and reason with respect to the post-liberal order with Catholic University of America Associate Professor of Theology, who is a leader in this movement that is analyzing, that has examined the ideology of liberalism and its failings and is proposing new ideological alternatives. Well, Chad, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me on, Andrew.
Well, starting out, liberalism has, what are its problems?
I'm sorry, my connection missed your question there a little bit.
Oh, just starting out, what is liberalism and what are its problems as an ideology?
Well, that's right. I mean, we tend to, when we hear the word liberal in America, we tend to think that we're talking about the left. What we're really talking about when we talk about liberalism is an 18th century idea, that is predicated on a kind of individual liberty, small government, state will be new, sort of.
Is looking at this ideology, you sort of touched upon that. How would you define right and left liberals? You have liberals as opposed to left liberals. Oh, hey, Chad, we lost you there for a while.
I'm really sorry about that. Modern technology, it's great when it works and bad when it doesn't. Liberalism is a kind of 18th century idea that we adopted in various ways. There's right and left forms of liberalism, but basically liberalism is the idea of individual choice and small government toleration of differences, neutral with respect to civil religion, and everyone will just go along to get along. That has proved disastrous because what it has led to is a sort of war of all against all, because people don't get along go along to get along. What has happened is we don't have religious neutrality. We actually have a kind of we had a civic religious Protestantism, which was especially manifested in the 20th century as the Protestant mainline, and then that collapsed. And so the kind of ecumenical Protestantism, which was prevalent in America, was replaced by a kind of progressive religion, by wokeness, and we're going through this massive civic religious structural transformation right now in America. And what it has proved is that liberalism just isn't sustainable. And the reason why liberalism isn't sustainable is because its ideas are wrong. You know, human beings are religious by nature, and we actually need to have a religious, civic religious order. And actually, individual liberty isn't sufficient for having a community, which is ordered to the common ends. So what we're finding is that we're really in a post-liberal moment. We're in a moment in which it's very clear that liberalism doesn't work, and we're not sure what replaces it.
Well, I guess your main idea then you're saying is that this neutrality idea is not sustainable because ultimately, you know, anyone can think up anything and, radically transform the nature of society, the regime.
Yeah, well, I mean, in a sense, what the idea of religious neutrality is actually a very recent idea, one that was really not implemented in the courts until the 60s and 70s. Religious neutrality has its origins in liberalism, its origins in the idea of what the popes called religious indifferentism, that would just tolerate all religions equally, whether they're true or false. But what I think we see is that human beings just cannot tolerate religious neutrality. We are all religious, and we're actually going to be intolerant to religions which differ from ours. And so we actually need a kind of civic religious cohesiveness to have a nation, to have a country, to have a people. And I think that's something that our classical political thinkers always understood. They always knew that. I think in the great tradition of Christian political thought, we always knew that. It was really this modern liberal experiment which, you know, was predicated on these myths of the wars of religion, and it was predicated on this idea that you could do without a civic religious structure, and what we've seen is that it doesn't work.
Well, thinking of that, how would you describe then what has been often termed among conservatives the idea of fusionism that you have,
right.
or people talk about the three stool conservative. Natural family values, limited government domestically in the economic sphere, and then assertive foreign policy abroad. How has that worked out, or how has that failed, or how do you evaluate that traditional conservative ideology since World War II?
Right. I mean, William F. Buckley was, the famous kind of fusionist who put together the three-legged stool, as it were. I think it was, in a sense, the sort of what Buckley did was, in a sense, the best sort of thing that you could get in the 60s and 70s, in the sense that he saw and others saw the need to have some sort of conservative resistance to an unhinged liberalism, as one might say, in Buckley's Up from Liberalism, we find a kind of standing athwart approach in the fusionism, but standing athwart did not work. Right, progressivism just went right through like a steamroller. Through all of this, in a sense, what we find is that commitment to limited government, commitment to individual liberty, commitment to the free and open market, commitment to endless foreign wars to expand the liberal imperium actually doesn't help conservatives. It doesn't actually help the family. It doesn't help the worker. It doesn't help the church. It doesn't, because all of those things actually aid and abet a progressive regime. And so I think what we see, in addition to the failure of liberalism, or rather the failure of liberalism, has shown forth the failure of the fusionist strategy to resist progressivism. It just doesn't work.
Liberalism more broadly, has the United States, since its founding, you know, in the Declaration of Independence, always been liberal? Or for that matter, are our political traditions from the United Kingdom, are these British political traditions, is it right to describe them as liberal?
Well, I mean, this is something, of course, now being disputed in America, and I think we have Patrick Deneen to thank for that being a dispute. I mean, I think it's impossible to say that liberalism is not represented in our founders. Absolutely, our founders were very much learned from liberal writers on the continent, including John Locke, but it's also true that our founders were drawing on classical traditions, right? So, you know, my friend Adrian Vermeule at Harvard Law, you know, talks very persuasively, I think, about how the American legal tradition, at least, is drawing deeply upon on common law tradition, on the classical legal tradition. And so I think we see in law various kind of basically conservative paleo preservations of Roman law that are, I think, could be a source of renewal and recovery from the failure of liberalism and the totalitarianism progressivism. So I think it's true that we have very liberal strands, which have sown liberal seeds in America, which have been destructive. But I also think it's true that we have classical strands that we can pull upon, draw upon for inspiration in thinking about how we can reorder our country around true principles.
What are you talking about, development of a civic religion? How would a post-liberal look sort of fundamentally different from today?
Well, I mean, I think one of the questions, I mean, I can't speak for all the authors at post-liberal order, but I know that I think that post-liberalism primarily describes the failure of liberalism rather than describes some future order. In a sense, I think what we have to talk about is what comes next. You know, in a sense, if what comes next is a progressive civic religious structure to America, then we are all doomed. But I think that is not sustainable. I think that a false religion, which the woke progressive want to privilege, is inherently unstable because it's false. And so I think whatever emerges in the future, I think we have to say what we at a baseline. What American civic religion should fundamentally affirm is the one true God. That's certainly within our tradition, right? As I say in my essay on the religious nature of the city, we have these aspects within our own constitutional legal tradition which privilege the one true God. Right? We have Sunday laws, blue laws, we used to call them. Sabbath laws, they're sometimes called. Those are things which I think if you did something just as basic as revive blue laws, you would actually unite a concern for the worker and the rights of the worker. You would affirm the importance of worship, the worship of God, and you would communicate to Americans that actually commerce is not the highest good. Acquisition is not the highest good, that the highest good for us is actually to rest in God. And one simple thing like that already would begin to allow you to see how different America would be. And that one thing would be an enormous kind of resistance, I think, to the progressive tyranny that we're seeing now.
Well, and speaking of such blue laws, how far would they go? The question we're looking at now, you know, we're coming up on Super Bowl Sunday. I mean, what would be restricted? What would be allowed? How would you conceive of that?
Well, I mean, for one thing, we should have Super Bowls on Saturdays, right? Football is a game, and you should be able to play games on the Sabbath, but for football players, it's all work, right? So we shouldn't be they're doing work on that field. And so, you know, one simple thing would be for people to, shift their future to shift to Super Bowl Sunday to Super Bowl Saturday.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, so I guess that would be something that would kind of, you know, you have to do that. I mean, I guess I think of my experience in Europe. I mean, there, like in Germany, you do indeed have, various sort of shop closing laws and so forth. And so, you know,
yep.
Sunday is a day when the gas stations open and so forth. So it's a more restricted business environment.
Yeah, and I think it communicates something. You know, I mean, and it's totally constitutional. We have incredible amounts of cases that support Sunday laws. You know, sometimes if you say blue laws, you'll get some atheists saying, it's unconstitutional, separation of church and state. But anybody who knows the law knows that that's absurd, because basically the whole American constitutional tradition supports blue laws. And it's incontrovertible, but you can't argue against it. There's so many cases that support blue laws. In some places, the blue laws are still on the books, just not enforced. So I think the same in Germany. There was a major challenge to these laws which restrict stores from opening on Sundays. And in 2009, the German High Court upheld it in Germany. Look, this is legal. This fits our constitution. We can do this. Now, no one thinks of Germany as a kind of, paragon of religious devotion. But if you can do it even there, where we're in a very virulent progressive secular society, surely we could reassert blue laws here. It's, I think, the kind of thing that is often said to people like me is that you're not very practical. You're just imagining, a kind of theocracy, or you want, something that isn't there. But in fact, getting very practical about something basic and simple and constitutional, like a blue law, actually is how you move the ball forward on questions of order.
Yeah, well, one other issue that you brought up, I believe particularly in your presentation that you did on the religion in the ancient city recently, and it was put into an article at the Post in the area at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Alexandria. You also mentioned the idea of blasphemy laws. What would blasphemy laws look like in a 21st century America? I mean, I believe it was Adrian Zamora, if I'm correct, wrote a Harvard school note. Going into the 19th century, there are all sorts of blasphemy laws in the United States that were upheld by state Supreme Courts, and I think even I forget if you listed a federal Supreme Court decision, but you know that was of course in an America that really. Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's interesting. The blasphemy laws go way, way back because, I mean, I think, you know, this goes to your earlier question about whether or not America, you know, has any non-liberal resources to draw upon. And what, of course, the American founders all knew was that the states all had established churches. And so what the early American vision was for the federal government neutrality with respect to religion wasn't some sort of religious indifferentism, but a recognition that the states all had their own civic religious structures, be they Catholic or Baptist or Methodist or what have you. And that's where our blasphemy laws come from. They come from this pre-liberal strand in which we recognized very early in our founding that religion was central to the unity of a commonwealth, and that states were real commonwealths, that states weren't sort of subsidiary, you know, departments of the federal government, but actually were sovereign. And as sovereign commonwealths, they were held together by a civic religion, and that the civic religion recognized God. It was cognizant of God. And blasphemy laws were in a sense, the negative side of that, the enforcement of, you know, just like now we say, well, you can't say anything without getting – you'll get fired if you blaspheme, you know, some sort of protected woke class, right? That's the kind of – we have blasphemy laws right now. We just don't call them blasphemy laws. Anything which, you know, offends the faith, the religious sensibilities of the progressive is punishable. And the early Protestant civic religious structures of at the American founding did the same thing, only instead of like thinking of, you know, certain woke protected classes as speaking against them as blasphemy, it was you couldn't offend God. You couldn't speak against the faith. You could not speak against belief in God. And that is a kind of restriction. Now, the penalties were very light, but very light penalties are a teacher. If you're going to be fined, you know, $15 for offending a blasphemy law, maybe it's just a slap on the wrist. But in a sense, that's how all polities actually discipline and order themselves, is actually by saying yes to some things and no to other things. And blasphemy laws are no different than that. They're just saying that we're going to honor God in this society. And we see remnants of that on our money. We see remnants of that on our buildings when we see a sign that says, "In God we trust." We see remnants of a culture which still recognized that we placed God above us, that America wasn't the highest thing, that democratic will wasn't the highest thing, but that God was.
Well, maybe going back to the Declaration of Independence, which any norm maybe say that you can't go against the idea of the God of the laws of nature and of nature's God, you know, this idea of natural mm-hmm. law precisely that's expressed in the Declaration of Independence and indeed is in the common law. I mean, there are all sorts of cases in both in the United Kingdom and the United States saying that, you know, Christianity is part of the common law. I mean, the whole moral basis of this common biblical basis. I mean, would you maybe have a provision saying that you know, society can say, look, you know, our order is founded upon a moral monotheism, a good God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm willing to be an incrementalist, you know, about these things. So it's, you know, it would be better for us to have a state which was cognizant of the one true God. If one wants to call that, you know, the philosopher's God, if one wants to call that the God that Aristotle and Plato recognized, that would be better. That would be an improvement on the sort of capricious God of woke culture. what I would prefer is actually something that's closer to our tradition than even nature and nature's God, which is a kind of deistic notion. But what I would prefer for us, and what I think is actually a recognition of the God who has spoken to the world through Jesus Christ, that it is the God who has been revealed to us in Christ who is the God that we put our trust in. Is this Christian nationalism? No, because I'm not particularly committed to nationalism. But I am committed to the idea that every polity needs a civic religious structure that's true, and that the only civic religious structure that's going to be stable is the truest one, and that's going to be Christian and indeed Catholic.
Well, you know, I guess that gets back into the point that this law note at Harvard Law School, it's online, about blasphemy laws. I mean, there in the discussion of these cases, these court cases said, you know, you can have any debates you want about religion, but, you know, if you want to say you don't believe Jesus is the Messiah or, you know, I don't know, advocate Islam or something, you can do that. But again, they sort of drew a line at, like, you know, maybe insulting Christianity or sort of the...
Right. I mean, I don't know. Probably most listeners probably remember the sort of piss Christ. I can't remember the artist who did this. Do you know the urinal?
Yeah, piss Christ was Andre Serrano.
Okay, thank you. Well, I mean, that's clearly. Yet what we settled for this kind of radical relativism in which anybody can say anything they want about religion. And I actually don't think that's our tradition. I think that's become our default position, and it's been horrible. I remember a prominent conservative who actually defended the Black Mass at Harvard back when there were Satanists trying to promote a Black Mass at Harvard. And this conservative defended the Black Mass at Harvard because of free speech, because people should be able to say whatever they want. And, I mean, that's part of this kind of civic religious disorder, which has been introduced by liberalism and which has become extremely toxic under progressivism. And what it leads you to is actually saying, yeah, satanic masses at Harvard is okay, as long as we present another alternative. And you have to think, well, on some level, that's deeply confusing to our young people. What's it telling our children? What's it telling our students? It's telling them that actually we should be indifferent to religion. We should treat all religions the same, that there is no such thing as true religion. And if there's no such thing as true religion, well, there's probably no such thing as truth at all. And if there's no such thing as truth, then what is the meaning of it all? And so I think what we've communicated is this kind of what Pope Benedict called the dictatorship of relativism, that once all things are possible, then you really have sown the seeds of totalitarianism.
I have free speech, freedom of religion. If we make the distinction between liberty and licentiousness, license, you know, liberty is defined as it's the freedom to become what you ought to be, whereas license is just simply doing whatever you want. So there's, you know, a difference between, you know, discussion of Aristotle on the one hand and, say, you know,
right,
drag queen story hour in the public library for kids on the other hand, or there's a difference between exploring, you know, what is the good God on the one hand versus, you know, opposing outright evil and statism.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the better conversation to be able to have is, you know, in a sense, to be able to say, we actually should be able to have a debate about true religion and false religion, just like we can talk about whether, you know, a political idea is true or false. We should be able to talk about religion is true or false, and we should prefer true over false, and we should not think that it is impossible for us to arrive at a conclusion because we're reasonable. It doesn't coerce the act of faith. The act of faith isn't something that can be coerced in anybody. But someone could lack the act of faith and also say, actually, I think if a religion is true, that Christianity is the true religion, and this, we've seen actually many cases of this, of people who recognize Europeans. Habermas was like this in certain regards. People who recognize that Christianity is actually the religion which is true and which is best for everybody, and this is what we should privilege. That doesn't coerce anybody's faith. What it does is structurally privilege a true thing rather than claim neutrality and allow a false thing to occupy the vacuum that's left by the neutrality.
Yeah, I mean, maybe the state should have the ability then underneath its conviction or blast that we have to any sort of really an evil religious belief. I guess that gets into questions like, you know, you talk about other faiths like Islam, and of course, you know, has its own, you know, that's always in discussion today about all of its blasphemy
right.
laws, a death from blasphemy in Pakistan and so forth. You know, maybe there you'd make a distinction that, you know, such Islamic beliefs, you know, they're not promoting human well-being, that we have to have a standard mm-hmm. of, you know, God is love, and love your neighbor as thyself, and, mm-hmm. and as well as loving God with all of your heart. So that's a clear moral standard of judging religious speech as well as speech in general.
Right. I mean, I think, you know, liberalism likes to talk about carve-outs, you know. We'll give you Catholic carve-outs on religious conscience. What we've seen is liberalism really can't give carve-outs. It pretends to give carve-outs, but it doesn't. It actually is also very restrictive. And I think, you know, in a Christian order, an order which could recognize and give actual protection to Jews, for example, to protect those who are not themselves Christian, but could actually receive benefit Christian order. I think, you know, there have been historically and can be again ways of actually protecting people, and actually protecting people in the most profound way, because we recognize that every person is made in God's image and deserves protection under law. But that doesn't mean that all of their views will be protected, but it means that they will be protected. And so I think actually Christians have a much, much better understanding of what a carve-out would mean, because our carve-outs would actually respect the dignity of the image of God in every single person, even if we didn't believe that their religion was true.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess maybe turning at the economic sphere, you know, you mentioned the importance of the family and protecting that. What would a post-liberal order look like? What sort of, in terms of the economic sphere and promoting strong families and strong communities?
Yeah, I mean, again, I don't take Post should describe the future as much as a sort of statement of where we are right now. Whatever emerges in the future, though, has to be based on true principles. And so what are those principles that are going to privilege the creation of families? You know, I look at Hungary's policies on encouraging family life, or recently the president of Madrid in Spain, you know, giving 50% tax reductions and 100% tax reductions after you've had a certain number of children. Those are really serious and interesting policies which absolutely prioritize the family. Without saying that anybody who's not forming a family is somehow in deficit, but that the highest good for any nation, any people, is actually producing more citizens who can care for the common good of that place. And so it behooves whatever politics emerges in the future to have a family policy that says, you know what, we need to encourage men and women to get married, for them to have marriages which are strong, in which one income can support the whole family. whether the mother goes and earns it or the father goes and earns it, that one income could actually serve the family and that they could have babies. They could have not just the 1.2 babies that we're having, which is decimating us, but they could have 4 babies, 5 babies, and that they could build strong families. And strong families would build stronger communities, and stronger communities, stronger states, and a stronger nation. That, in turn, I think it's a little bit like the blue law, that if you have a family policy that really privileges the medium and large-sized families, you will have a massive knock-on effect for the cultural and political and civic religious order. So I think family policy is one. I think industrial policy is also crucial, because sort of industrial policy, do you need to get to the place where one income will actually support a family? What does the state need to do in order to order its industrial life to be productive, to be profitable, in such a way that every family doesn't need 2 incomes? If we thought about industrial policy keyed to the need for a single-income family, it would radicalize, in a good way, the American workforce. It would benefit the worker. It would, I think, would it restrict our GDP? I don't think so. I think what it would do is it would force us to prioritize things, and it would force us to think about producing things in America rather than buying everything from China.
All right, then. Well, excellent. For our listeners out there, you've been hearing Chad Pecknold, an associate professor of systematic theology at the University of America, and the failings of the ideology of liberalism here on Conservative Casual Friday, a weekly Blog Talk radio show with your show host, Andrew Harrod. And we'll hope you join in next week for another episode of Conservative Casual Friday. And for Chad Pecknold, how can we find out more about your study?
Thank you very much.
All right, then. Well, thank you for joining the show, and tune in next week for another episode of Conservative Casual Friday.